Hello all, and welcome. My name is Frank Ruder, and together with my colleague Aaron Hamza, I welcome you to the new episode of the Crisis and Critique podcast, Philosophy and Its Other Scene. Today's guest is someone who basically suspends the very idea of being introduced, I think, in a way that even exceeds the formula, the commonly used formula of someone not needing an introduction. I'm doing the impossible thus, and I will mention a number of introductory words in the most profane manner, just to indicate how impossible it is. So I'm reiterating what I just already pointed to. And then afterwards, Aaron Hamza will start off, kick off our conversation. Judith Butler is Distinguished Professor at the Graduate School and former Maxine Elliott Professor in the Department of Comparative Literature and the Program of Critical Theory at the University of California, Berkeley. They received their PhD from Yale in 1984 and published numerous influential, highly influential, famous, and I mean, given the present ideological climate, one could also say infamous books, Subjects of Desire, that was 1987, Gender Trouble, 1990, Bodies That Matter, 1993, Psychic Life of Power, 97, Excitable Speech, 97 as well, Antigone's Claim, 2000. I'm leaving aside the subtitles, forgive me, just because there are so many and they're all so important. Precarious Life, 2004, Undoing Gender, 2004. I'm jumping ahead a little, Frames of War, 2009. Parting Ways, Jewishness and the Critique of Zionism, 2012. Senses of the Subject, 2015. Notes Toward a Performative Theory of Assembly, 2015. The Force of Nonviolence, 2020. What World Is This? A Pandemic Phenomenology. A phenomenal book on the experience everyone went through in 22. Numerous translations into numerous languages. Soon there will be a new book next year on the anti-gender ideology movement, which we will, I think, sort of talk about indirectly, directly in some way with some of our questions today. Thank you so much for being with us, Judith, and taking the time. It's immensely appreciated, and I think we're both looking forward a lot.
Great, thank you. I'm very pleased to be with you today.
Judith, thank you. Thank you so much for being with us here. So I'll start with a first question, and which we thought will be like a bit of a politically tamed question, so to speak. How would you articulate your relation with and to Marxism? Do you think Marx's work is relevant in our present historical and political conjuncture? If it is not, what is missing? And if it is, how, in what way could we identify its relevance?
Yes. Well, thank you. Well, maybe I could start a bit autobiographically and then move to the question of the present that you pose. As a young person, about 14 or 15, I started to read philosophy and demanded in my own way individual tutorials in my schools. And for the most part, I was indulged. And I certainly read Marx then, although nobody could teach me Marx, and because that was not being taught in the schools, primary and secondary schools. So. But I did read Eldridge Cleaver. I read Black Marxism at the time. And I also read Marx's early manuscripts, what was available to me then. And I considered myself a revolutionary, although I couldn't quite answer the question. What kind of world I wanted to bring into being, but I was fairly certain that I wanted this one to be overturned and that it would be a good thing if it were. And then later in college, I studied economic anthropology and also read Marx more academically, and really enjoyed the field of economic anthropology, especially the ways in which we were asked to think about how the economy has been prior to capitalism embedded in social structures and historical norms, and that it became a separate area of study, and that the market became treated as something distinct only with the rise of capitalism. And this was a very important field for me, but it also set me up in an odd way to refuse certain kinds of distinctions that my Marxist friends were making, like, well, here's economics and here's culture and society and history, and you're on that side and we're on this side. It was like, well, wait, I thought that we actually were learning something from Marx's pre-capitalist economic formations or the extraordinary work that followed. So I actually understood myself as involved in economics, but not in the way that took the economic sphere to be distinct. And I was somewhat surprised when Marxists themselves started to, or told me, you know, I'm still fairly young, told me that it was separate and had to be, and that I was on the cultural side. And some of my good pals still say that to me, but I'm still in conversation with them. You know, it set me up, the reading Marx, especially the pre-capitalist economic formations, which became something of a paradigm for economic anthropology, you know, the work of Mark Bloch in history or Harry Pearson in economic anthropology. I was not, or Karl Polanyi's role in that, in the formation of that field. So I, you know, I had already deconstructed or had for me deconstructed a set of oppositions that turned out to be alive and well, both among the capitalists and the Marxists. So I was disoriented in the theoretical field into which I eventually emerged. And of course, I also went to Germany as a Fulbright scholar in, I guess, 1978, 79, a long time ago. And on the one hand, I went to Heidelberg to study German idealism. And I suppose that brands me as a true idealist, and maybe I am. At the same time, once a week, I went up to Frankfurt to hear what Habermas and his critics were doing. So, you know, I've always been shuttling back and forth, and in my teaching and in the formation of the critical theory program here at Berkeley, I've always taught Marx, but I have focused mainly on the early manuscripts, the German ideology, and Capital Volume 1. I certainly know the Grundrisse, and many of my students are, in fact, quite committed Marxists and read widely. I love reading Marx, and I think Marx has, first of all, a kind of irony and piercing insight that would help us in this day. We don't have a lot of really good criticism of the kind that Marx offered. And I guess I should also say that the 18th Brumaire has been enormously important to me, both as a teacher, but as a thinker, since I think we have all experienced this moment where you anticipate a revolutionary uprising, and everything is set up for that revolution to take place. And then it takes another turn, and it turns out the people you were expecting to rise up in this fabulous way maybe are committed to fascism, or maybe they're committed to authoritarian states, or maybe they're discriminating against other minorities who don't fit their more or less narrow idea of what the working class should be. And, you know, I suppose the final thing I would say here is that, you know, as somebody who works in gender studies, I was very formed by socialist feminism and those debates. They became really important for my thinking about kinship as an historically variable structure. So from Engels through, the socialist feminist legacy has been enormously important. And my more recent work with Ernesto Laclau before he died, thinking about new social movements and how we think about them in relationship to a traditional notion of class, but also Etienne Balibar, who remains one of my most treasured interlocutors in this world. Okay, there's much more to be said, including what I think about the work of Angela Davis, who I think is constantly trying to renew Marxism in light of questions of feminism and race, and showing the interconnectedness of these issues without precisely being intersectional. That has been enormously powerful for me, and has shown me more or less that we shouldn't accept the idea that there's a kind of Marxism over here that's only concerned with a homogenized notion of class, and then there are new social movements over here who are messing things up. I don't dare by that. I think we need the larger solidarity, the larger alliance, and an analytics that is worthy of that.
Thank you so much. I mean, we can take a cue from your comments on the 18th Brumaire, because or very directly, the 18th Brumaire deals with failed revolution, with a strange repetition in constantly worsening forms, right? An attempt to break out of what seems to be almost maybe one could say historical parapraxis, right? It's one intense revolution and it constantly goes wrong. So in this sense, around the time that Marx problematizes these things, it's a bit earlier, but still, psychoanalysis enters the scene.
Yes, it does.
And just to repeat somehow the same question that we already raised, vis-a-vis psychoanalysis, how do you relate to psychoanalytic theory, psychoanalytic practice? Is that a partner in your project, in your endeavor? Are there limitations you see? I mean, of course there are limitations, but yes. How would you relate to what is your take on that, on psychoanalysis?
I personally find that psychoanalysis is enormously useful. I don't really accept it as an entire package, nor do I work exclusively within that framework, but I find myself turning to it on key occasions. And I suppose when I started writing about gender, it was during the North American AIDS crisis, which I say very distinctly because there are different histories of AIDS and some of them are quite contemporary. So we can't say AIDS is over, it's not over. And even the good drugs that are available are not always affordable in different parts of the world. And we know that there are massive geopolitical differentials at work in the assessment of where we are with AIDS. But at least in the North American instance in which I was absorbed, it was quite shocking that people would lose their lovers and their friends and were not able to have any public acknowledgement of that loss. Or couldn't tell their parents, or couldn't be out about it because their sexuality was criminalized where they lived. I thought about this certain form of psychic suffering where you undergo a massive loss, but you cannot acknowledge it, and there's no words for it. And of course, Freud did talk about melancholia in that way, and so I wondered whether we could talk about a broader cultural melancholia. Are there where certain kinds of losses remain unspeakable and have to be suffered in this way without acknowledgement? And if there is no public language for a loss, then that suggests that there's also a public organization of who can be grieved and who cannot, publicly speaking. And given that grief needs the mark and needs the public acknowledgement, according to Freud, you can't openly mourn without openness to be pushed back in the closet, not just in relationship to your desire, but also your grief struck me as a form of psychic suffering. It was also social. So for me, I'm always trying to push in the direction of the psychosocial, like how do psychic processes get organized under certain social conditions, and how do social and cultural norms also enter into psychic life in a way that reorganizes them, but also tells us something about the forms of suffering and potential that exist from within a psychoanalytic, socially inflected framework. I mean, that's just one example of it, but that's sort of how I work.
Yeah. Well, can we maybe move at the beginning of your philosophical career, which was in phenomenology? We think you wrote your thesis with Maurice Nathanson.
Yes.
Who was himself a student of Alfred Schütz. Schütz drew from phenomenology in order to create the foundations or basis for sociology. Does this relationship, maybe even rivalry between sociology and philosophy or even theory as such, plays a role in your thinking?
I find it extremely interesting to think about philosophy and social theory together. And, you know, the phrase social and political philosophy usually only appears in certain kinds of philosophy departments. Not all of them go that way. They might have political philosophy, and then they might work very hard to say, well, there's political theory over here and political philosophy over here. I mean, I take the wide lens. I want to read Weber. I want to read Schütz. I want to read Rousseau. Probably I'm not going to find them in a philosophy department. Sometimes, rarely you find Rousseau, but mainly over in political theory. So I'm constantly traversing those boundaries and worry that certain questions can't be asked well if we stay stuck in narrow disciplinary frameworks. I did appreciate that Maurice Nathanson, my advisor, would reiterate this comment from Sartre that if a philosophy can't describe, you know, what's happening at a table in a cafe, if it's not able to give an account of ordinary life in some interesting or illuminating way, then it's really not worth it. And so, you know, for him, philosophy couldn't just exist in a self-referential way. It really had to be engaged with a description of the world. And I appreciated that very much. I didn't end up following a strict phenomenological, you know, trajectory. And I worked on the wrong phenomenology, the different one, Hegel's, which I loved, only because as I started reading so-called French philosophy of the late 20th century, I found that this concept of desire was really crucial for a lot of thinkers. And I was thinking, well, who were they reading and why? So I went back and looked at Hegel on desire, but desire and recognition as concepts are obviously in my work in different ways, in gender of war and precarity, in ways that I don't know, I wouldn't know how to track, but I'm aware that it's there.
I think we can very, very well tap into the question of, let's say, the link between philosophy and sociology, or the what you call psychosocial norms, or the psychosocial normative earlier. Because recently, in the most recent episode, we talked to Alenka Cupancic, member of the Slovene School for maybe one could say philosophical psychoanalysis. She just wrote a new book on Antigone. You also wrote a book on Antigone.
Yes.
Which appeared in 2000, Antigone's Claim, Kinship Between Life and Death. And you show in that book, I mean, to abbreviate massively, that Antigone, in her take on the strange and paradoxical choice she is given, on the forced choice, one could say, she allows to problematize natural kinship relations and their normative restrictions, which then has massive implications also for the discussion with psychoanalysis, because if one takes Oedipus on the one hand side as a normative paradigm, or Antigone, one ends up somewhere very, very differently with very different normative settings. So we wanted to raise the question, do you think we can still learn something? Is Antigone's claim, to cite the title of your book again, still pertinent today? Does it have to be rearticulated? Is it still telling us something? Is it maybe more forceful than ever? I mean, we were thinking here in part of the new kinship, that is abortion legislation, that were implemented very worryingly from a perspective from the other side of the Atlantic, in some states of the US, for example.
Yes. Well, thank you. You know, Antigone is an interesting figure. She can't be a model for political action. And Alenka, I think, also makes that clear. She argues that that Antigone is, in fact, a kind of self-negating character. And I understand that. But one reason that Antigone remains interesting is precisely because she refuses solidarity at the moment in which she's offered it. She wants to be alone in her defiance of Creon. Her sister says, oh, I'll take care of it, or I'll come with you. It's like, no. You know, she wants individual, what we would call heroism. I'm not sure that's really quite the term, but I would say it's a heroic individuality of the proto-feminist. And I think that you can't resist authoritarian power alone. You can speak for people, you can be exemplary. I don't think she is, in part because she doesn't have a strategy for taking down that power. She does show that power can be rivaled and imitated, mocked, that she can speak in the voice of that same power. And I think that's absolutely maddening for Creon to see that he doesn't possess the voice of power. She actually enters into his grammar and gives it back to him in a quite powerful way. But Antigone is a kind of example of courageous speech under conditions in which it is fatal to speak. So if we ask the question, what would it have taken for Antigone to live? That is to say, not to end up dying at the end of that play. Well, it would have taken a really well-orchestrated uprising of a whole lot of people who wanted to see a different kind of power. So my way of reading, which is not exactly Lacanian, and maybe even not psychoanalytic, is to ask, what would it have taken for Antigone to live and for something other than a self-defeating political project to have emerged? And that means experimenting with the book and allowing the figure to change. So I'm interested in the fact, you know, that Antigone is also trying to mourn her brother and that this is a singular relationship. She doesn't think the state should have anything to do with that. It's made very complex by the fact that the state is also her uncle. So she's trying to articulate a difference between kinship and the state, and it keeps re-entwining and re-entwining, right? So, you know, much like I was saying earlier about the economy, it's a kinship. It's not really an autonomous system. I know that the structuralists really wanted it to be. I understand why. I even think the work of Marshall Solins before he died was a kind of last effort to give it a kind of autonomous character. And I appreciate that really deeply. If anyone could have done it, he could. But kinship is constantly being worked through the law, right? Legal entitlement to my child. I mean, it took 2 years of fighting, you know, to even like, yes, you are in fact parents, like, thank you. There's an inevitable intertwinement there. And, you know, I would also say, not that Antigone should be the frame over and against Oedipus, but Oedipus has been widely overestimated as the only possible framework for psychoanalytic thinking. And many of the feminist thinkers like Jessica Benjamin and others, and Nancy Chodorow in Object Relations, or the newer work in relational psychoanalysis, have made clear, like, there's the pre-Oedipal, there are some other things. Juliet Mitchell says, what about siblings? Why didn't we start with siblings? Right. So, you know, there are many people coming in at different angles. Or Laplanche, let's just talk about a primary caretaker. It doesn't have to be the father, the mother, or Winnicott, who just said, well, it could be a maternal field. You know, it's let's not focus just on the mother. So there have been social and historical changes in the psychoanalytic paradigm that interest me. And, some older versions, maybe more normative versions of psychoanalysis have obviously, and some Orthodox Lacanians have been instrumental in pathologizing gay and lesbian families and the like. So we really need to push back against that orthodoxy if psychoanalysis is going to continue to inform social and political theory and practice in some interesting ways. I think it can, but I think it needs to push back against those more normalizing and rigid orthodoxies.
Thank you. Can we move to another continent? Since mid-September 2022, there's been a series of massive demonstrations and civil unrest in Iran. This all started with the murder of Mahsa Amini, but her family used to call her Gina, if I'm pronouncing this well, which in English translates as life. But the Iranian state doesn't permit its citizens to be registered with a name that is neither Persian nor Islamic. We think this is only one of the aspects of the historic discrimination against the Kurds, not only in Iran, but in the entire region, so to speak. What is really fascinating about is that her national belonging is not mentioned neither by the Iranian progressives or leftists, but neither abroad, but in at the international level. So we were wondering, what is your view of the protests in Iran, and how do you see the Kurdish question in general?
Yes, it's a great question. Well, I don't know how well educated I am to answer this question well, but of course I read and I'm in touch both with Kurdish feminist groups through my friends in Istanbul, but also I know some of the history of the regional issues there. I think we have many issues going on. I have great respect for the protests in the street, especially the young girls who are running through the street and singing. I think singing is great. I remember when people from Tahrir Square came to Wall Street and they said, well, where's your music? And people said, oh, we don't have music, but we have a library. And they said, no, you'll never have a revolution without your music. So I think the song, I love the singing. That's open mourning. And it also links mourning with rage and a demand for justice, which is maybe the Antigone for the present that we're trying to think about. I think that there's also, I mean, it was complicated for me because there were some people who contacted me and said, we need you to denounce the Iranian regime for being theocratic. And I thought, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to do that. And the idea being that if they were not theocratic and secular, they would not be doing this. But we know secular regimes can inflict enormous abuses. So I was concerned about that. And I also wanted to make sure that wasn't an anti-Islam position. At the same time, I did want to, and did on occasion, condemn the Iranian regime for its brutal repression and its murders. And I worry, you know, the problem with the example, right? Like this young woman, of course, she's the example. She stands for the oppression, but the press did not, the major media did not follow how many young people were killed, how many protesters were killed, and how many of them were put in the political prisons there. So, you know, there's no follow through when you focus on a single issue, because it's that figure who comes to condense and represent the entire movement. You actually need a little bit more patience to find out who else is being affected and what are the modes of resistance. I think that for many people, the fact that that Kurdish people are not recognized as such or are treated in a deeply demeaning or subjugating or effacing manner within Iran, it's not part of the public understanding. But I think it is really important. And in fact, the Kurdish people, as we know, have been suffering disproportionately in this massive earthquake catastrophe and have been explicitly targeted by the Erdogan regime. I have enormous respect for many of the people who are struggling for Kurdish autonomy and trying to get international attention on that issue is no easy matter. I'm not sure I addressed your question, but those are my thoughts about it.
Maybe I think we can connect the next thing we wanted to raise quite well to this two issues, maybe of what one could call female emancipation that are linked to the feminist movement or the signifier feminism, because it seems to be quite a, if that's an okay thing to say, a topsy-turvy one, or in to a certain degree a disorienting one in the contemporary situation, which brings back maybe some motives we touched upon in between the 18th Brumaire and Antigone, so to speak, the vast fields, maybe the, not the maternal field, but maybe the feminist field that lies in between of them, simply because if one thinks about what are the present weaknesses, let's say theoretically and practically, and maybe also the strengths, but maybe the, addressing the weaknesses or impasses is an interesting way of approaching the contemporary situation. I mean, if one considers, for example, the relationship between gender theory and feminism, it has been quite a difficult one in the most recent period. And we were just thinking of the role that some, I'm in Scotland, so Nicola Sturgeon just resigned because of some, I mean, linked, one could say, to some legislational changes that she implemented vis-a-vis self-determination rights that directly pertain, right? I mean, to the ways in which people self-identify, and two problematic cases, which fueled exactly, I think, the position of some very prominent TERFs. I mean, just the trans-exclusionary radical feminists that often endorse very conservative positions. So we wanted to raise what is your take in the contemporary situation? What are the challenges for a feminist position if one factors in, if one takes seriously the insight of gender theory? And what is the ideological topsy-turviness that we're right now facing?
Well, I have to say that the way in which this topic is treated in the UK is very different from how it's treated in the rest of the world. So I think something very specific and intensified is happening there, maybe in part because when the National Health Service in the UK opened up a public debate on whether young people should be able to identify or whether adults should be able to identify with whatever gender they choose, it produced all kinds of views on this topic, and it was opened for public debate as part of the policy consideration, right? So they had the policy, then they opened it for public debate, and sure enough, you got a state-sponsored intensification of a conflict that otherwise could have been dealt with in a much better way. So, you know, for me, I don't understand. I mean, it would be very sad to me if we said there's gender theory here and feminism over there. No, gender comes out of feminism. There's no contemporary way of thinking about gender critically without feminism. I myself am a feminist. There's no question about that. Of course, gender, we could say as a term, like precedes feminism, both in its grammatical history, but also in sexology and John Money's clinic and the rest. But for the most part, anthropology, economics has used gender for a very long time. And that's within the feminist framework. So I must refuse that standoff, right? Because it deprives me of my feminist history and commitments, but it also, it's a tactic. The distinction is itself a tactic in a battle, right? So if you accept the distinction, you're pushing gender out of feminism, and you've already agreed that they're separate, but the debate is about whether they're separate. No, I don't think gender has to be the only paradigm within feminism, right? There are people who work on sexual difference. There are people who work on intersectionality who use gender differently. There's, you know, it's not like the only framework, but I think we have to be careful here. In Argentina and throughout Latin America, as I'm sure you know, the Ni Una Menos movement and many of the movements that came to Europe and to other parts of the world as massive feminist mobilizations are constitute the largest feminist mobilizations of our time. And I've been shocked to see how feminism has become just such an important galvanizing force on the left throughout Latin America. And it is it's a form of feminism that is trans-inclusionary. Like, the state has deprived trans people of their rights, or has deprived women of their rights, or women in a large sense, inclusive, obviously, of trans women. The rates of femicide, or the killing of women, the rates of the killing of trans people are both very high and very much linked in a patriarchal order that believes that violence against women, trans people, gay and lesbian people is somehow okay, because it's either supporting a sexual order that is heteronormative and patriarchal in character, or because these are crimes of passion and passion is okay as an alibi. If the state itself is criminalizing or fails to enforce its laws, people do feel that they're free to act on their hatreds in some ways that are completely unacceptable. So the alliance has, there has to be an alliance between gay, lesbian, bisexual people, asexual people, queer, trans, gender nonconforming, whatever the multiplicity is. We need to be connected, not on the basis of identity, but on the basis of a shared opposition to state violence and to other forms of violence, a shared commitment to freedom, the freedom to live and move on the street. And this includes, of course, centrally in Latin America and elsewhere, indigenous rights, rights of belonging, rights of movement, rights of protection against the violent violent forms of not only the physical violence targeting indigenous people, but the violence of extractivism and the violence of dispossession and the violence against the earth and the various life forms that are intertwined with that land. So I feel like we need to keep we need to be really clear about what we're opposing. We need to be opposing forms of authoritarianism and extractivism and racism. These are interconnected. We need wide ways of thinking and broad solidarities to stand any chance. And these small internecine fights are, they're just painful. And they've lost track of who the enemy is. It's very sad to me. But I do think in the UK, the state-sponsored debate has actually made the focus more narrow. What should kids at the Tavistock be told? Okay, that is an important question, and I have some views on that. But it's not the only political issue in the world. I mean, depathologizing trans kids would be just the basic thing. You know, when and where hormones are given, when and where surgery becomes an option. We can publicly debate all of that, but you don't strip people of their rights and you don't deny them recognition that they ask for. This is like a basic. There is no solidarity that can be built if those simple requirements are not met. I think that was more of a rant than an answer, but okay.
I like the rant.
We would like to talk a little bit more about the contemporary situation, but we can follow up very nicely from what you said. Donald Trump recently said that should he be elected, he plans to strengthen.
Exactly. Okay, you just traumatized me, but I'm here.
Yeah. He declared that should he be elected, he plans to strengthen the nuclear family, and he would push a bill that recognizes only two sexes, which are determined at birth, and no gender. This seems to further decrease the right to self-determination and bodily autonomy, especially after the overturning of Roe and versus Wade. All this clearly shows, as you said, that these issues are highly highly politicized. What is your assessment, both political and philosophical, of these developments that could hardly seem more reactionary?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Trump already tried to do this once, and he failed. He asked the health department to declare that gender is sex assignment and that there's no distinction between them. And the health department, the health ministry that we have refused to do that. But look, he's giving his version of a playbook that is being circulated by Orban, who also wants to define the family as in a heteronormative way. By Meloni, who claims that gender or gender ideology will make it impossible for people to say mother or father because those terms will be somehow outlawed by the radical gender people, which I find you know, almost funny, except that it has enormous power to incite people who are worried about all the ways in which their lives have been upended economically and through climate disaster as well. And by Putin, clearly, who understands that the family is under attack by Ukraine, because Ukraine is becoming part of the European Union, or is allied with the European Union, and their gender mainstreaming norms will be an imposition of gay ropa on Russia. So in 2015, right, Putin says that these movements, gay and lesbian movements, feminist movements from the so-called West, are all attacks on Russia's spiritual center or values. And he in fact named gender in particular as a national security threat. So, but we have to, you know, ask, like, what is the incitation that that this is meant to accomplish? Because Trump cannot get it through. He tried already and it didn't work. But I think that he's appealing to people who are disturbed by new family formations, by gay and lesbian lives, by feminist freedoms, including the freedom to get an abortion if you want to, and if you need to. And he's trying, I think, as are some of the rest of the ultra-conservative leaders, to demonize gender so that it's the place and it's the force that is destabilizing the lives. Like, once we return to a heteronormative order, we'll have order. We will, all the anxieties and fears you have about the future will be fine. So it's a, you know, it's a false ticket to order, but it obviously appeals to a lot of people, as does Meloni, who does a pretty good imitation of Mussolini when she starts talking about gender.
I mean, to stay with the demonization of theory, it's pretty interesting that there is a strong belief in the efficacy or practical efficacy of theory, only from the wrong people, one could say, right?
Yeah. I mean,
and like recently, if we're informed correctly, the Florida Board of Education banned critical race theory from classrooms.
Yes.
In Florida.
Yes.
I only saw some reports where there were actually no books in schools, in some schools, right? I mean,
yes.
which is really bewildering and puzzling. We were thinking, how does that affect, or how would you account for that against the background of your earlier reflections on words or discourses, on signifiers that can hurt or inflict pain? We're thinking about the excitable speech book, of course. So in a vulgar way, is that almost like a weaponization, a weaponizing of the idea of vulnerability for the most conservative and reactionary purposes, like a reappropriation of a trope, almost, of an idea, of a concept that was once had clearly emancipatory potential and is right now, these are attempts to appropriate that very potential for the exactly opposite purposes. Is that what is happening? Would you say that? Or,
Well, it's hard. I mean, let's start just with the concept, gender ideology, right? I mean, this is a notion that emerged out of the World Congress of the Family, and it was discussed in the over the last 25 years, if not more. The Vatican took some pretty strong stands against gender, and the idea of gender as an ideology is the idea that it is one position, it's a dogma, and that those who adhere to it are either totalitarians, as some of the German critics have said, or they are trying to seduce your children. They're a danger to children. They're trying to teach children to be gay, or teach children to masturbate, or teach children to be trans, or, you know, and of course, the idea that it's an inculcation, that, okay, here's the dogma, and now we're going to impose it on people, and these kids have to, you know, they're recruiting, or worse, we're pedophiles who are seducing. So, you know, for some, it is a diabolical ideology, and in fact, the Vatican did use that word, suggesting that this is the contemporary work of the devil. And if it's the devil, it will try to trick you, and its aim is to defeat God, to be the rival to God, and to defeat God. So when Pope Francis said that gender is like a nuclear bomb, or likened its adherence to Hitler Youth, we recognize right away that this is an inflamed idea of the power of a certain kind of construct. And, you know, we could take it apart intellectually. He doesn't think people should be free to choose their gender. He can accept gay and lesbian people as long as their sexuality is not a choice. That's not an expression of freedom. It's a necessity of some kind. You know, they're God's children. We have to accept them. But there's also an idea of freedom that is very frightening to at least some of the both evangelical and Catholic opponents of gender, which is also, I think, clear in the abortion debates. Should women really have the freedom to decide, or should pregnant people more broadly to decide to have an abortion or not? Or should that be the state's interest? And the US Supreme Court said it's the state's interest. We need to intervene because women should not be exercising this freedom. Right. So the limitation on freedom is very intense. And I'm talking not metaphysically or anything like that. I'm actually talking about political freedoms. So we could all have different accounts of why we have the sexuality that we do if we have one, or why we're drawn to be this or that gender, or how we experience that. You know, those are all interesting intellectual questions. But, you know, should this be a permissible zone of freedom is the question that many people are asking. And when the Vatican says, look, they think they can create themselves, those trans kids, those trans people, those genderqueer, whatever, they think they can create themselves. Well, the power of creation belongs to God alone. They're trying to steal the power of creation. Now, most gay, lesbian, trans people don't think they create themselves from nothing. They are dealing with a complex constitution. Like, this is my desire. This is my identification. We can debate about where that comes from. But the idea that the political freedoms that gay, lesbian, trans people should have, women, pregnant people, that those political freedoms should be restricted because freedom challenges the primary place of God and religious authority is really central, I think, to this whole this whole thing. And you know, and it's contradictory in some interesting ways, right? Like, oh, if I'm a gender theorist, then I believe in a set of precepts like somebody who believes in the Bible, right? I mean, I cite things, I believe them, I don't think about them critically, and I impose them on others. I mean, they've never been to a gender and women's studies class where everybody's arguing about every term. Okay, anyway, we adhere to dogma and we impose it, but they're actually projecting what they do onto us and then imagining that we're a kind of rival dogma or a rival authority, just like the devil is coming to defeat God. We're the rival authority to religious authority. You know, I could go on and on, but it's an astonishing configuration. And it links, you know, the same almost, I think, within 10 days of each other, Putin said, you know, if we let Ukraine win, European gay gender ideology comes in, we won't be able to say mother and father anymore. Meloni said the exact same thing in Italy. It's like, where are they in conversation? No, but there are these world congresses and a very amazingly effective digital network on the right that does propound and repeat these phrases in different parts of the world, sometimes the very same phrases.
I think we can move, but connected to another topic. You criticized identity politics, and I'm quoting a sentence from Notes Toward Performative Theory of Assembly. It fails to furnish a broader conception of what it means politically to live together across differences, sometimes in modes of unchosen proximity, especially when living together, however difficult it may be, remains an ethical and political imperative. Is the current reemergence and intensification of xenophobia, racism? You mentioned Europe, but I would also add there Poland, you know, with their right-wing government, which has been going on for quite many years now. But Latin America, India, US as well, at least and at one level, this emergence, is it like an outcome of the failure of identity politics and maybe even strengthened by it?
You know, I think this is a complex matter because what people call identity politics differs across the political spectrum, and why they tend to call something identity politics rather than something else is also kind of interesting. So, you know, Black Lives Matter, would we say that's identity politics? It's about Black people, yes, but it's also about police violence, and it's also about state violence. Also about prisons, it's about radical inequality. Why wouldn't we say it's a justice movement or an equality movement? Why do some people say, oh, well, that's identity? Now, it could be that some people on the left think that that all these issues like race and gender and class, and usually it's said with some exasperation, that you know, we need a broader left framework and that these are subordinate, they're secondary, or they're important to include, or but there's a broader framework that has to take precedent over that. In a way, I understand that, but with Black Lives Matter or with Ni Una Menos, perhaps the very idea of freedom is being redefined, or maybe the very idea of equality is being redefined. And if we're committed to radical democracy, and we know that over time we are asked to rethink the basic concepts by virtue of challenges, especially the challenges of those who've been excluded from the history of freedom or the history of equality. It's like, I see you're committed to equality, but it's not for me or not for mine. I just feel that we need to hear a little bit differently what some of these movements are about. Now, I think there is a kind of left that thinks it has either a Marxist framework or an overall framework that's being chipped away at by what is called identity politics. But maybe those are actually challenges to the framework that the framework needs to take up in order to have a broader coalition. So, you know, I mean, I think we just need to rethink that more broadly. What I do worry about is people who say, well, I only enter politics from the point of view of my identity and for people who share my identity, and my aim is to achieve recognition or justice for this identity and this identity alone. Now, if we do that, but we're okay with discrimination or oppression being suffered by others, then we are contradictory. We're not generalizing from our condition or asking what kind of solidarity we have to have with other people who are in a similar kind of situation, maybe not the exact same. Which is why it upsets me that feminists, some feminists who say that they're in favor of the rights of women to exercise freedom, are not in favor of the rights of trans people to do the same. So what would it mean to limit one's the generalizability of the form of freedom that you're defending? It means you're actually committing a rather severe contradiction, because you are agreeing to discrimination on the one hand and fighting it on the other. So I think those kinds of contradictions need to be overcome. I am in favor of kind of ever widening circles of solidarity. I think there are forms of cultural, linguistic, political translation that have to happen for solidarities to emerge that really work. I want them to be transnational. I don't want them to be like revivifying the nation state as the necessary framework within which people elaborate their political goals. So I, you know, I have some skepticisms of the critique of identity politics, because I feel like it's not being heard right. And then I also have my own concerns about very narrow views that aren't interested in the broader solidarities that we need.
I think that the next issue we wanted to raise and talk about with you is directly connected, because it concerns somehow the question of identity and solidarity, or maybe one could say identity and universalizability of a certain position, namely that pertains, maybe one could say, to the material conditions of theory, namely to the framework of the university. I mean, you are the best person to raise this question to. You're a distinguished professor with a distinguished career. You're clearly someone who Foucault would have described as a creator, inventor of a new discursive regime, one could say. So that distinguishes you on three levels at least. How would you describe the status of higher education today? I mean, to raise the age-old question already raised by Kant and others, what do you think the role, what is the situation, what are your thoughts on the university today as somehow the material conditions of transmitting certain theories? What is the role of humanities within that? It's a huge question, we know, but we think it's important to raise it, especially because, I mean, it's not easy to make a career in the humanities for many, many scholars out there, PhD students, right? Especially when they follow certain paths that are politically contested and highly, highly debated.
Yes. Well, you know, I think in recent years, maybe the last decade or so, we've seen a shift from an interest in public intellectuals, you know, who could be identified as such, to the idea of the public humanities. Public intellectuals put these distinct and exemplary individuals into the limelight, and of course there are many, and they do great work very often. But the public humanities is different. It's an orientation of the university towards the public world, and a recognition that the world outside the walls of the university is also inside the walls of the university, and those walls are porous, as they should be. So my sense is like that the university is not a place for the transmission of theory. I'm not sure I'd transmit anything, maybe, I hope not. But it is a place where certain kinds of critical thinking takes place. And by that I mean, really considering what are the presuppositions of our ways of knowing and our ways of living. How are they leading to destruction? How are they implicated in forms of violence or forms of exploitation or oppression? What are the promising dimensions of our public worlds? How do we think about them? What about the arts? How do they galvanize us or give us a way of thinking about our world in a new way, or even planning or pledging a different world than the one we're in? So I I think that open critical debate on key topics, especially those that are controversial and difficult to talk about, is the task of the humanities. We have to read closely and carefully what is it that people are saying. Let's not use a paraphrase. Let's not come in with a prejudicial understanding of a position. Let's study, turn it over, have a public debate, allow your own viewpoint to be revised by what someone else says, be asked to return to the text and show me the evidence for your claim. I mean, these are not just activities that happen inside the university. They happen in public debate. And we either act like we know already what critical race theory means. And in Florida, people will tell you, some who oppose this idea, who have never read the books, you know, can't spell, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw's name. Those folks will tell you that, oh, critical race theory has a single message, and that is that we are a racist nation. Well, we reject that, therefore, and we don't want our children to be told we're a racist nation. So it's like, well, let's see, what does it say? You know, where did it start? What are its claims? What is the importance of the legal framework for this theory? What kinds of standing does a person need to have to make a legal claim? How did critical race theory emerge from certain kinds of reflections of that sort? What is it saying? What is it not saying? What other, you know, kinds of studies in the field of race are there that are different paradigms? You know, like it stands for everything. What other critiques of racism are there that were not part of that particular legal movement? I mean, we either say we're not interested in knowing what we're talking about, we just want to oppose it because this figment of my imagination is politically useful to galvanize a reactionary public or to pull them in a reactionary dimension, or we bring our thinking out into the public, which is what I think we actually need to do. The university needs to open its walls and be part of public debate. And, you know, you don't have to become a dry scholar to ask some key questions, like, what is meant? Have you read this? I met a woman in Switzerland who came up to me after a lecture, and she said, I pray for you. I said, why? And she said, because you don't accept the biblical claim that God created man and woman. And she looked at me like, what's wrong with you? And I said, it's natural. God created nature, and this is a natural distinction. And I said, well, nature permits of some complexity, actually, and maybe there are different ways to read the Bible. And she was like, no, that's not the case. And then I said, did you ever read my work? Anything from? And she said, no, I would never read your work. I would not touch such a book. And I thought, exactly my point. If she touched the book, she'd be contaminated, or she'd be trafficking with the devil. Like, right? So it's critical race theory, gender. The whole point is never to read them, not to know what they stand for, so that you can substitute a phantasmatic projection for a reading. It means those of us in the university who think critically, or even part of critical theory broadly construed, need to be out in the public world talking to people, trying to make clear what is happening. And that also means publishing in media that are not academic or not narrowly academic. So, you know, we can't just hang with our own people and, you know, think, well, at least we're smart, they're dumb, right? That kind of cultural arrogance doesn't work. We need to be involved in the practice of public thinking. And more people are doing that. I see that. It's extremely important.
Well, let's move to another topic. One of your recent books, I don't think it's the last one, I think it's the one before the last, examines the force of nonviolence. A nonviolent position, if we may rephrase you in these terms, inscribes an ethical stance into the political field. Confronted with another war in Europe, and also clearly referring to your Frames of War book, we were thinking about how would you assess the Russian aggression against Ukraine? I mean, more concretely, we were wondering, what do you make of this situation where it seems quite impossible to even think about a non-violent position?
Well, you know, I've been in touch in the last year with some Ukrainian feminists who are clearly in favor of self-defense. And I would never say Ukraine should not defend itself against Russian aggression. No, I would not say that. My point about nonviolence is actually one that some of them also think about, which is how do we create a world in which nonviolence can become a shared norm? And of course, for me, nonviolence is not a principle that I impose on situations like, oh, you should be nonviolent no matter what the circumstance. It's rather a perspective that asks the question of how do the tactics we use also reveal the kind of world we want to make. So you could see it perhaps in the tradition of prefiguration within Marxist theory. Like, are we acting in such a way in resisting aggression that we risk becoming like the aggressor, or are we acting in such a way that will end this aggression so that we can live in a world without aggression? And it's a way of testing tactics to see whether they hold up. Are we bringing more destruction into the world? Are we bringing less destruction into the world in acting in the way that we do? So a number of the Ukrainian feminists I spoke to are still holding out for a nonviolent world. I mean, in a way, that is their aim, but they want more arms, and they want stronger diplomatic efforts, more courageous ones, more clever ones. And I think, you know, I think that's where I stand. I do believe in self-defense. I was trained in self-defense as a young feminist, and that's an important idea. But, you know, in self-defense, you know, the violence comes at you from the outside, and you try to move it against the one who is attacking you. And that's an important principle of Aikido. It's an important principle of struggle. So I guess what I'm critical of is the idea that you can, I mean, let's put it this way. When one defends, or a country defends itself, how does it make sure it's not committing the same atrocities? How does it make sure it's not becoming like the power that it opposes? And that's a kind of ethical moment in the midst of a political conflict. And it's one that I think needs to be constantly posed in the course of a justified resistance to aggression, as we see in the Russian-Ukrainian instance.
To move from the philosophical and political discussions onto somewhat, well, maybe lighter, but maybe not lighter terrain, but at least to another scene. Soon there will be the Oscars happening in a few days, and there have been quite a number of politically charged movies around that were appraised. And we were in general just wondering if you have seen anything that you found intriguing, incisive, bothersome, or whatsoever. We were just thinking, for example, Tar raises the question, intricate questions, maybe somehow, that relates to the entire Me Too movement and questions of power, the Banshees of Inisherin, questions of friendship and identity in a very, and maybe also when friendship tips over and becomes libidinized and what that means for censorship. The triangle of sadness is maybe an articulation of how frustrating it can be to play through all the forms of resistance against capitalism. And they all fail. Everything seems to fail, and how to represent it. This is just an arbitrary list. And if you tell us you haven't seen anything that was worth your while, that's obviously fine.
No, I thought The Triangle of Sadness was a brilliant film, quite frankly, for the reasons that you say. You know, what is a resistance, and how is it that what you resist can nevertheless enter you and take you over, or partially take you over, or you realize that there's a kind of constant failure involved in a resistance to something that is that powerful. Tar, I found complicated. I wasn't as much a fan as some other people that I know. I accept the thesis, as it were, that that women harass, men harass, they, as professors or as mentors, we do have a certain kind of power. People who work with us depend on our ethics, because their well-being and their futures depend on our ability to support them. And when we undermine their well-being by getting involved with them, or by involving them in our own narcissistic circuits, we fail as mentors. We fail ethically. So even though I think there's lots of libido everywhere, that doesn't mean we act on it all the time. And in certain circumstances, it's benign, and in others, it's actually potentially undermining. But then I have to ask, like, for that film, the way it gets taken up, like, oh, good, finally, we now see that women harass too, and that means it's not a problem for men to deal with, or it's not primarily a problem for men to deal with. And I think for most people who think about this, most of the harassers are men. And which doesn't mean that women don't exploit narcissistically their students in ways that are unacceptable. But I do believe that the film shifts from the, tries to erase the structural problem of harassment as mainly one in which more powerful men are exploiting less powerful women. So the heteronormativity of harassment, the masculine privilege that harassment articulates, that gets backgrounded. So on the one hand, yes, of course, there are women and it's wrong. On the other hand, if we make that into this central statement at this moment in time, are we deflecting from the structural dynamics that should be the focus? I also think there was something else going on in that film about kind of European civilization and the love affair that this working class American had with certain civilizational ideals, which I found very painful. That, you know, that class, the class dimension of that film wasn't talked about as much as some others. And I also found rather disturbing the final scenes, which struck me as a kind of rank Orientalism. I wasn't quite sure whether we were supposed to think that being in a nameless East Asian country, possibly Thailand, and playing in that setting with people in masks and costumes was like the most demeaning thing in the world you could do. Were we also asked to, as viewers, to agree in that this was vulgar and horrible? I mean, it was vulgar and horrible in light of her her values, but are they supposed to be our values as well? And I was very suspicious of that ending and thought that the film was maybe complicit in the idealizations that it was also trying to expose. Also, her German wasn't good enough and she's not a plausible lesbian. So it was really weird for me.
My partner said that the conducting acting was also not very believable.
You know, it was histrionic. It was histrionic.
So can we move from here to your relationship with artistic practices in general?
Yes.
How does the contemporary art, let's say music, theater, film, affect your work at all, if it does?
It does. I would say that some of my most important public engagements have been through arts institutions. So for instance, the Center for Contemporary Culture in Barcelona is a place I've gone to many times. And what I find really important is the way that art events and public discussions work together. I've worked with many people in performance studies because my own work has contributed to some of the theoretical apparatus of that field. And that's been very important to me. Certainly written about painting and films on occasion. But I think that I've recently been thinking about the climate activists who threw food or paint or onto iconic works of art or glued their hands to them. And on the one hand, I very much appreciated the critique of the museum and the elitism of that kind of cultural institution. On the other hand, I feel like a lot of museums are trying to open themselves up as new public spaces for performance, dance, discourse. And so it's also important to me to be part of that becoming public of the museum, the opening of the door. I do think that so many people find it impossible to imagine the future. They're terrified. Many young people are terrified. There is no future, either because of fossil fuels and climate destruction, or because of the overwhelming wealth disparities that capitalism has produced in this its late stage, that there's no way to imagine the future, that it's just terribly grim. I think that sometimes artworks or art experiments can allow us to think about things we otherwise find intolerable to think about, rather than throwing the food or the paint on the artwork of art, I would like to see radical aesthetic experimentations that try to imagine the world otherwise or help us to deal with what feels impossible to think about, to overcome our denial about extractivism and climate destruction, to overcome our denial about violence so that we can thematize it and work with it a bit more constructively. So I actually put a fair amount of faith in aesthetic practices to help us think the unthinkable and to imagine a political future that's more compelling and stronger than the phantasms of the right wing on gender and race and whatever else they're carrying on about. We need a powerful imaginary that can counter the imaginary of the neo-fascists and the authoritarians. And I don't know where that comes from other than a politically engaged kind of art form.
I think that connects, we're slowly approaching the end already, but that connects well. I mean, the question of, let's say, the political value of an artistic imagination of what seems impossible to imagine, this counter-imaginary force. What would you say? It's a very broad question, and we're almost asking for a slogan, but please don't give us one if This is too much of a reification. What would you say the ultimate stake, just again, turning it back to the contemporary situation, for political action, for political practice and theory is today?
The ultimate state, did you say?
The ultimate stake, the ultimate, what is the most precious, the most pressing concern? Just to identify, not the solution, but the task for which then are, I mean, yes, it's an impossible question, we know, but maybe not.
I think that maybe I would accept the distinction between faster and slower forms of violence, that there are ways in which whole populations are being plunged into poverty, precarity, forced into displacement, forced migration, abandoned to toxic environments, and also ways that people are being incarcerated or killed, or killed in war, or killed in continuing violent assaults, as we see in Palestine. I think that for me, linking the institutional forms of violence to the explicit forms of violence is extremely important in order to build a solidarity that understands and resists the violence of capitalism and the violence of femicide and all of this in an interconnected way. I mean, I think I am I would call myself an anti-capitalist for sure, and there are versions of Marxism I do accept. I'm not sure capitalism alone can explain everything that we need to be thinking about right now. So I'm not sure there's one issue. Maybe the one issue is the inter-articulation of these struggles and, you know, the commitment to building forms of solidarity that accept the differences among struggles and the interdependency of the struggles. And that is what we need an imagination for, a critical imagination, whether it's in the academy or on the street or in the arts institutions or in aesthetic practices that are outside of institutions altogether. I guess that's my answer.
So we want to end this with a series or either or questions. I mean, you can elaborate on your choice or you don't have to. Can we do this?
Go ahead.
Yeah, okay, so the first question. Either or, Hannah Arendt or Walter Benjamin?
Oh, the two together. You're asking the wrong person these questions. The two together and in the end, Benjamin.
Okay. So the second, Julia Kristeva or Sigmund Freud?
Sigmund Freud.
Okay. The third, Wagner or Beethoven?
Beethoven. Maybe surprising.
The fourth one. So the fourth one, Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden?
Bernie Sanders.
Oh. The fifth one, Hegel or Marx?
Both. Both.
And the very last one, Lenin or Mao?
Ah. Probably Mao.
Mao. Well, okay.
If I had to.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Judith.
Thank you so much. It was really great.
You know, Okay, why can't we talk Gramsci? Okay, anyway, go ahead.
No. We...
It's all right.
Thank you so much for being
Thank you very much. Okay. Take good care.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.